11, 2005, and we are going to have a the House Committee on Trade, Economic Development will come to order, and we will have an informational meeting on the Oregon Tourism Plan for 2005 to 2007. It's a public testimony, and I'd like to invite Todd Davidson at this time, my good old friend. Already you are there. Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's good to be back before your committee this morning. Good morning, Representative Nelson. When I was here before the committee last time, I had an opportunity to really just provide you an update on how tourism is performing in Oregon. And at that time, I mentioned that come May, we would be ready to release our 2005-2007 plan. And your committee administrator made note of that, as did your chair, and asked if I would be able to come back this month and sit down with you and talk to you a little bit, give you kind of a top-line overview of our 2005-2007 plan. The details of the plan are there in front of you, and I want you to know that we are receiving public comment on this plan until June the 2nd, and then the commission will be formally reviewing those comments and adopting the plan at their next public meeting on June 17th. The bottom line is this, and each of you, I believe, already is aware of this. This is an amazing time to be in Oregon and an amazing time to be part of Oregon's tourism and hospitality industry. Because after over a decade of working to identify additional resources at the state level and dedicate resources at the local level for tourism marketing, in 2003 we saw the passage of the Oregon Tourism Investment Proposal, which is helping dedicate local resources that are available for tourism, enabling the Tourism Commission to be even more market-driven and market responsive, and move the statewide tourism marketing program from a $3 million annual budget to approximately $8 million annually. During the 16 months that the legislation has been in effect and the 9 months since first revenues were received, the Tourism Commission has expanded the number of programs, implemented several new ones, and envisioned this time when the full fiscal impact of the Oregon Tourism Investment Proposal would be realized, the 2005-2007 biennium. Through every program, every great idea, every minor tweak, we have strived to never take our eyes off the prize. It's why we do what we do. It's about jobs for Oregonians, good jobs for Oregonians, jobs where they can learn their work maturity skills and jobs where they can establish their careers. It's jobs where they may become part of a multinational corporation and jobs where they may be the sole proprietor, showing up every morning and unlocking the door as well. Today, over 88,000 Oregonians owe their jobs to visitors traveling and spending dollars, euros, yen, and other currencies in our state. And we've watched these expenditures grow, not only during the last decade, but especially during this last year when we experienced 6% growth, our fastest rate of growth in the past 5 years. And I'm thrilled to be before you today and celebrate the fact that visitor spending in Oregon has reached nearly $7 billion annually. So our objective at Travel Oregon is to sustain this momentum, to build a plan that is grounded in research, it serves the industry in our state, and it preserves the product that we treasure. So what I'd like to do this morning, very briefly, the chairman has asked me to keep my comments to approximately 15 to 20 minutes and then allow some time for questions, is just walk you through the three broad program areas of Travel Oregon. And I will start with our domestic consumer marketing program. Probably the best place to start here is to talk a little bit about the overall objectives of our consumer marketing program. First and foremost, we need to make sure that we're differentiating Oregon from our competitors and continue to establish the Oregon brand. We have to build awareness among consumers that Oregon is a must-see, perfect destination for them and for their family. We want to motivate consumers to seek additional information, not just stop there with the seeing of the ad. We want to help consumers plan their vacation so that we can lock in their itinerary decisions before their trip as much as possible, hopefully extending their length of stay then in Oregon as well. We need to translate their interest in Oregon into a sale. We need to get them as close to that buying decision as is possible and generate that idea of coming here and turn it into a tangible vacation product that they can buy, whether it may be a theater ticket, a rafting trip, or a hotel stay. And we want to build a relationship with them over the long term so that they come back again and again and tell their family and their friends. The print advertising, of course, is the cornerstone of our marketing plan. We're now 1 year into the Oregon We Love Dreamers campaign. It's a campaign that continues to reinforce what captivates Oregon visitors, from our stunning natural beauty to our unique people, culture, and quality of life. We do this by incorporating page-stopping photography set against Oregon's one-of-a-kind settings. And we often do it with a sense of humor as well. We tell wonderful stories that bring the Oregon vacation experience to life. We've created 10 different ads so far, so I wanted to put up a slide that showed a few more of them. We're running in over 24 different publications across the country, and we plan to develop new pieces of creative during this biennium. Since the launch of this campaign and our increased funding, we've seen significant increases in our response rates. For 2004, we touched nearly 1 million consumers when they responded to our advertising, either through calling our 800 number, writing to us, or emailing us, or visiting our website. And that was for only 6 months with the enhanced funding. 2005 is already trending positively. We're up 35% year-to-date over where we were same time last year. Of course, for us, it's all about collaboration with our partners. It's one thing for the state to make an investment in the tourism marketing programs, but it's critically important to us that we provide linkages for our partners to dovetail their marketing budgets into the state's marketing budgets. So we're going to be developing a variety of different co-op advertising programs, the media partnerships, where we work with the in placing travel content on television news and lifestyle shows as well. We plan on doing airline co-op advertising. There is so much new air service into this state, not only into Portland, but into all of our other airports as well, that we want to work with airline partners on co-op advertising and promotional programs. We're going to be developing print advertising that includes a package call to action. In other words, we'll use the ad to build the image and the awareness, but we'll also have packages that will be included that our partners can then run their ads, and we can actually use that package to stimulate the interest in buying an opportunity to come to Oregon. We want to take a look at television. We've received a lot of inquiries about that. Television is a medium that obviously intrigues us. We do think it's very expensive to move into television, but we think there may be an opportunity to do some very specific niche television programs in some selected markets as well. And then the niche print advertising program. We're going to look at a co-op advertising campaign with some of our key statewide partners, whether it's the wineries, the birding groups, the cycling groups, and others, because we think there's some very strong niche opportunities for us as well. And then the advertising partner program. This is where we put together what we call a deck, where each of the publications that the Tourism Commission is advertising in is put together for our partners as well. What's important to note is because of the strength of our media buy, we're able to negotiate incredibly strong rates for our partners as well. So, for example, the Yamhill Valley Vineyards Association may be able to come in and buy advertising through our program less expensively than they would if they were to go out and do it on their own. The rates that they can get through us that we've negotiated with the magazine reps are often more deeply discounted than they would be able to go out and get on their own. Some of the additional co-op advertising programs are that we're going to continue our regional cooperative advertising program, where the regions around the state develop ads that mirror the state's ads but focus in on a theme that's very specific to them. Our Travel Oregon Lead program is where all of the leads for our advertising campaign are made available to our partners for just the cost of the lead. Oftentimes, you can buy these lists from private companies for, you know, anywhere from $5 on up per name. I've heard of some lists that are selling names, the more qualified, obviously, the better, for $10, $20, $30 a name. Our leads are available for 7.5 cents. And these are people who have already expressed an interest in coming to Oregon and perhaps also expressed an interest in traveling to a particular region of the state, perhaps a particular activity, whether it's wineries or rafting or whale watching, and we're able to really select those leads at a very micro level so that they can be very strategic in their programs as well. We're working with the Oregon Snow Sport Industry Association as they look to rebrand their marketing program so it's more consistent with the overall state brand. We're working, of course, with Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. We're running a four-state co-op ad and a web campaign in support of this commemoration in 2005 and 6. And we're also working with the golf courses throughout the state to more strongly promote the game of golf in Oregon because it's such a diverse and strong product for us to offer. We have a variety of publications that we produce, and rather than go through the list, I'd just like to point out that we're going to be looking at evaluating a statewide recreation guide. There are a number of different groups that are publishing a recreation guide for their particular niche. We're wondering if it makes sense to pull them together into a comprehensive outdoor recreation guide, whether that becomes a printed piece or becomes a stronger online presence is yet to be seen, but we're working to bring the groups together and have that conversation with state parks, the Oregon Guides and Packers Association, the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, and others. In media relations and promotions, there's a variety of new territories that we're going to be entering into. We're going to be looking at targeted pitches with an improved editorial calendar. We're updating all of our press materials, both those that are online and those that are offline, with a new Oregon multimedia DVD package that we're developing. We're using Bacon's media tracking service to help us monitor story placements across the country and establish a much stronger baseline as we move forward for the kinds of stories that are being run on Oregon. We're working with partners like the Oregon Wine Board and the Regional Destination Marketing Organization to increase the number of hosted media tours into Oregon. We're doing a variety of special promotions like the Oregon Bounty, where we brought together the Pear Bureau, the Hazelnut folks, the Oregon Wine Board, and the Dairy Commission to promote travel to the wineries in Oregon. And you know, we found out that Oregonians and others will travel in November in the rain, enjoying the wine country and all the other things that there are to see, because we saw visits to wineries during this promotion last fall increase by over 35%, and wine sales during the same time increase over 40% for the same time the year before. So we feel this is a very strong promotion and one that we intend to continue into the future. We're going to begin year-round direct mail campaigns because we have nearly 100,000 names in our database where folks have given us permission. And I want to stress that. This is not about spam. This is where visitors have told us they'd like to receive additional information from the Oregon Tourism Commission on new opportunities, new packages, and new ideas that we have for travel to Oregon. There'll be some media partnerships for mass media exposure, like the Do Action Sports Network. We're also working with PBS on Capriel and John's Kitchen. We're going to work to create a year-round presence in the lives of travelers by launching an online travel store and increase the collaboration with our regional partners and add value to their programs as we look to develop a statewide B-roll, which is basically raw footage that we can make available to broadcast networks across the country. And, of course, TravelOregon.com, our website, is becoming more and more important. Because of the trends of shorter travel planning periods and more frequent shorter vacations, we need a stronger, sustained year-round presence, and one of our best tools for doing that is our website. So this next biennium will be a critical growth period for our website. Just a few highlights for you of what we plan to do with the website is developing stronger strategic partnerships with content providers. There's a lot of great content out there. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We can go into relationships with some of these content providers and build a stronger online database so that folks can see all the different opportunities there are for travel in the state of Oregon. We want to be able to support the niche markets by working with Travel Oregon's sponsorships and promotions that we already have in place. We have stronger niche content where we're working with the cycling groups, microbreweries, wineries, hiking trails, and others so that we have an extremely robust database running behind TravelOregon.com so that the myriad of activities and events are available to them right there. And then we'll obviously work to optimize the search engine capabilities of TravelOregon.com and globalize the website, especially into German, Spanish, Japanese, over the course of this next biennium. And then we'll be implementing an online marketing campaign with keyword buys and other advertising on travel lifestyle and regional websites. On the domestic and international front, I would just like to very briefly tell you that our goal domestically is to increase the number of packaged travelers to Oregon. These are folks that are buying their trips to Oregon through travel agencies, and it does happen domestically. It's not only an international phenomenon. We work very closely with a group called the Oregon Tour and Travel Alliance. This is nearly 200 partners from across the state that are partnering with the Oregon Tourism Commission to better penetrate our work with both the National Tourist Association and the American Bus Association. developed a specific website for working with domestic tour operators and travel agents. It's OregonPackageTravel.com. It includes dozens of itinerary suggestions for them to consider, updates on what's new in Oregon, links to those nearly 200 members that I mentioned earlier, and mapping software for them to help aid them in planning their trips. We focus on the top three tour operators because we have found that to be our most successful strategy. If we work with the three largest, often the smaller tour operators will then follow what the bigger tour operators are doing. And we've found the strategy to be very successful in working with, for example, Tauk World Discovery Tours, because they're already promoting Oregon, and we're finding several of their smaller partner tour operators already picking up much that same product. So I guess what's interesting here is just a reminder that when you see a motor coach pulling into your community, it represents nearly $6,500 in revenue a day. And that's just the motor coach, and then you've got the visitors on the bus spending $100 a day on their own over and above what they paid for the package that includes the lodging and some of their other meals. On the international front, our primary markets are in support of the nonstop air service that we have. Obviously, Japan, the nonstop flight on Northwest Airlines from Tokyo into Portland. Germany is a key market for us because of the Lufthansa air service from Frankfurt into Portland. And then Mexico because of the Mexicana service from Mexico City, Guadalajara into Portland as well. The flights are doing well, especially during the high season. The key for us is to focus on winter product, and that's where we're really stressing a lot of our work right now, because that's the season where we need to be focusing. We've seen and heard and read about how Lufthansa sometimes needs to go from their daily flights to maybe five flights a week or three flights a week, depending on load factors. We need to get that flight daily. And so our focus is really on developing winter product. There are secondary markets that are obviously important to us as we support those flights as well. In Europe, we've learned that roughly half of the inbound seats on that Lufthansa flight are German origination. So that means the other half are coming from other countries. And obviously Italy, France, the Netherlands are key markets, as are Belgium, the United Kingdom, and the Scandinavian countries as well. And in Asia, in addition to Japan, which is the primary feed for that flight, Korea and China are critical markets as well. I thought you might be interested in knowing how on the international side we track our success, because doing direct consumer research in terms of ROI can be very expensive and therefore very cost prohibitive on the international scale. We were able to do this very effectively on the domestic scale. So there's a number of interim measures that we use. For example, we track total visitors to the U.S. and compare that to total visitors to Oregon. So we have an idea of market share. We look at the value of the media coverage that we've been able to leverage in U.S. dollars. We look at web hits to our international websites. We track what the tour operators are doing. We contract out to get tour operator extract reports, as they're called, where in essence we are hiring people to go through literally hundreds of tour operator catalogs and tell us, how's Oregon doing? Is there more product than there was last year? Is there less product? What type of product is being marketed, as well as what type of product is being purchased? The tourism industry services side is kind of that third big bucket of Travel Oregon services that I would like to conclude with this morning. This is the part of the program that you hear me talk about often in terms of how we assist Oregon communities and businesses in developing, enhancing, implementing their tourism plans, their marketing plans, whether it's for a business or it's for a community. There are five specific goals in this area. We want to work to provide strategic direction and proactive leadership and educational opportunities in support of tourism development throughout the state. We're promoting sustainable tourism development. This is about building a year-round destination. So we're looking at product innovation that's appropriate for the community. It's got to be consistent with their community values, and we also want to make sure it's coordinated with all of the departments of Travel Oregon. We want to encourage greater statewide year-round economic and returns to enhance visitor experiences and increased Oregon products. We want to integrate tourism where feasible into the development and policy framework of other state and federal agencies. There are a number of state and federal agencies that touch on the tourism industry. This is not just about the Oregon Tourism Commission. Obviously, the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department all have a role in the tourism industry, and we think that's an important connection that we make. And then at the federal level, of course, the Forest Service, the BLM, the Park Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, no surprise to any of us that as talk was going on about whether or not there was going to be a drought this season, the Army Corps of Engineers was obviously front and center with what the impact was going to be on our recreational lakes throughout the state, especially here in the Willamette Valley. And finally, working with local, regional, and statewide government and communities on what is the contribution of tourism to the state and local economy. Specifically, if we look at some of the things that we want to do, the first strategy is providing resources and educational opportunities. So we do publish our research. We make sure that we're out there conducting and providing relevant research information, whether it's on visitor profiles or it's on the economic impact of travel to the state of Oregon. One of the things that we're doing this year for the first time is taking our visitor profile and by enhancing the number of folks that we're actually surveying for that visitor profile, we'll be able to go beyond just a statewide visitor profile and provide every region of the state with a specific visitor profile. Because the one thing I think we all realize is that if you look at a statewide visitor profile, it becomes an average. Who's the average visitor coming to Oregon? Well, that person is not going to be the same visitor in southern Oregon as it might be in the Mount Hood Gorge area. Mount Hood Gorge may be far more dependent upon Washingtonians and people from British Columbia. Southern Oregon far more dependent on folks from Northern California and Nevada. We think it's important to discern between those kinds of visitor profiles by region and have worked with the regions to develop those visitor profiles early in the biennium. And obviously, we're also producing the Oregon Governor's Tourism Conference on an annual basis. Next year is April 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and we'll be in the city of Eugene. Some of the other resources that we provide is we manage the Tourism Development Grant Program, and we manage the State Welcome Centers through a contract with the Oregon Travel Information Council at the borders as you enter the state of Oregon so that we're able to provide you visitor information as you enter the state. It's interesting to note that some research that we've done on our Welcome Centers has told us that for every dollar we invest in running the visitor centers, we return $41 to the state. In other words, these folks were obviously coming to Oregon, but they chose to stay longer. They chose to do something they weren't already planning to do because of information they were able to pick up at these state welcome centers. Obviously, when it comes to facilitating the development of tourism product, here's where we're really working with communities with their tourism development plans. We're assisting in the development of niche markets, whether it's wineries, cycling, wildlife watching, and others, and supporting the development of scenic byways throughout the state. You may not know, but Oregon has one of the strongest scenic byway programs in the country, and because of that, and because Oregon was early to the table in the development of a scenic byway program, we have more nationally designated scenic byways in the state of Oregon than any other state in the country. Granted, Oregon is an incredibly beautiful state and deserves to have the largest number of scenic byways nationally designated, but it also bodes well for how our industry rallied to get those byways nominated, because were it not for that, we wouldn't have that recognition. And then within the supporting the tourism industry workforce development, our strongest program here is what we call our Q program, our Q Quality Customer Service Training Program. It's a statewide customer service training program where we actually certify employees in the tourism industry and work to support the development of tourism industry through enhanced guest experiences. For anyone with experience in advertising and marketing, you know the most expensive sale is the first sale. You know, getting people to try your product the first time. After that, you know, it's encouraging them to be repeat visitors. We believe that the stronger we are in the customer service we provide, the more informed our visitor industry employees are about all there is to see and do in Oregon, the better our chances for keeping them here longer on that trip and encouraging them to return in the future. So the Q is important because it provides standardized statewide customer service training. It emphasizes the importance of that training in the tourism industry, and we're equipping Oregon employees with the tools and resources they need to be able to better serve our visitors. So that, my friends, is a very quick overview of where we hope to go in 2005-2007. As I mentioned at the beginning, this plan is currently out for public review and comment. We'll be receiving those comments through June 2nd and then reviewing those and adopting the plan at our public meeting on June 17th. And that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman, and I would gladly entertain any questions that you may have as time permits.
That's an excellent presentation. Any questions? Representative Nelson? Always you have a question.
I always do. That's how I learn. I think knowledge is power. Mr. Chair?
No one can dispute that.
That's right. Be as smart as you someday, so watch out. You know, I just want to say, you were talking about the scenic highways.
Mm-hmm.
What you should include in here, and we don't have that. I wish we had that presentation you presented. But on your page 16 in this book, we have a number of military memorials, mm-hmm. and it's a very important part of individuals who, of the lives of individuals who come. And I just wanted to suggest to you that you start including those. We have here alone, you know, 370,000 veterans mm-hmm. in our state, and you know, times four to a family, well, that's almost half our state, yeah. 1,400,000 people affected, and they all have relatives mm-hmm. coming in, going. Mm-hmm. So I just want to suggest to you that you include that. And also, what I think would be neat is to have something called the seasons of benefits for travel, because we have four distinct seasons in Oregon, which, you know, Arizona doesn't have, many other states mm-hmm. don't have, and I just knowing just the beauty right now
mm-hmm.
of the rhododendrons mm-hmm. and azaleas and all those,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was thinking of that. This mm-hmm. the seasonal mm-hmm. programs are exceptional
mm-hmm.
here. And so that would, I think, that would be a great package to give to people, you know, choose your season and see. And also, when we first, you know, began talking about this program, I suggested that we identify at least one main attraction in every city in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in every county. Have mm-hmm. you done that yet?
What we have done, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, what we have done is we have worked with the communities and the regional DMOs. We're developing a database that will actually highlight those major attractions on our database front and center. That's the information I mentioned in the presentation, where I said we currently don't have the kind of database we really need to drive that buying decision. And so we're building the what we call the administrative interface, so forgive me for the technicality, so that then we can go to every chamber, every visitor information center in this state, and they can provide us online with what their major attraction is in every community and every county, so that then we can then take that, package it, and promote it to our visitors. So we're building the back end of that database right now so that we can do exactly that.
So a follow-up, Mr. Chair? So, you know, for example, since this is Lewis and Clark mm-hmm. here, you know, I would expect that to have been a big issue
mm-hmm.
for y'all. And, you know, for people to be able to come to the state and say, you know, take on this route, you're going to see all of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you take route 3, you're going to see all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be so incredible. For, you know, on your way to track Lewis and Clark and
mm-hmm.
on up to Vancouver and on over.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that would be so wonderful to have that, you know, as a visitor coming in and having a week or maybe 2 weeks to spend here, that we,
mm-hmm.
you know, have designated routes.
Mm-hmm.
Just on your talking about your beauty, and thank you for the support for our vineyards. We appreciate it. And of course, I'm very sad I don't see my museum in here. And living between the top two tourism attractions, Grand Round and Evergreen's Museum, which I'm very fond of since I started it in 74,
mm-hmm.
I think that aviation issue. We have a number of aviation museums, and I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you'll add it. And I'm curious of if the tribes are funding this tourism also. Are they?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
This program.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, while the tribes don't provide direct funding to us, there are a variety of places that they do partner with us. So it's not, while there's not a I guess I'd say an ongoing funding stream. There are a variety of places that they do partner with us in our advertising and marketing programs. We have a specific tribal tourism marketing plan that is funded by the tribes. They partner with us when we travel internationally, as well as domestically on a variety of trade shows and consumer shows, and they put partnership dollars into helping subsidize the costs of being there as well. So it's program by program, but they are certainly partners with us.
All right. Any other questions? Vice Chair Barun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Todd, for the presentation. It was excellent. A couple of questions I want to ask you. First of all, with that $7 billion in annual tourist expenditures or spending, First of all, where is that? How do you break that down? I assume most of it's lodging and food, but give me the broad spectrum there. And then what has been the growth over the last few years?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Brin, the $7 billion breaks down roughly as about 23 to 25% in restaurants, 23 to 25% in retail shopping, actually only about 10 to 12% in lodging. I believe most people do look at this as primarily being lodging driven, but in reality it's closer to probably 12% that's actually lodging expenditures, and far more money is actually spent in restaurants and retail shopping. The balance of the money then is obviously spent in transportation, whether it's gas, and there's also funding for recreation, whether it's a rafting trip or the leisure side of it, tickets to the theater, etc. And the growth, I apologize, the second part of your question was the growth. We saw about 6% growth last year, which is our strongest rate of growth in the last 5 years. Obviously, the terrorist attacks of 9/11 that were exacerbated by the recession of 2001 really hit the tourism industry across the country. In Oregon, we basically were flat. And that was positive. I mean, there were other destinations that actually saw declines in visitor spending. We just saw basically no growth. The average, if you go back over the last decade, the average rate of growth here in Oregon has run about 5% per year, if you go back about a decade.
Mr. Chair, one more question?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. I just, if you could speak briefly, to the question, your plan, which is excellent, I think, talks a lot about the marketing outreach to domestic U.S., other states, and, of course, international. Could you hone in just a little bit on what you're doing within the state to Oregonians, to my neighbors?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Brin, we believe marketing Oregon to Oregonians is a critical part of what we do, primarily because, first, we don't want to see the leakage. We don't want Oregonians to think they have to go somewhere else to have a great vacation, because we want to, and therefore we want to make sure they're aware of all the travel opportunities they have within their own state. Secondly, we believe the better Oregonians know and have traveled in their own state, the better ambassadors they are for our visitors that do travel here from out of state and literally out of the country. So that is something that is key to us. So we make sure when we're doing our media advertising buy that we're buying magazines that do also advertise to Oregonians. When we buy, for example, in Sunset Magazine, we buy the Pacific Northwest edition, which is heavy Oregon, Washington, as well as some of the other editions as well. We buy some publications that are Oregon only, or Oregon, very Oregon heavy, like maybe the Oregon Coast Magazine or Northwest Travel Magazine. We also use the Oregon Bounty campaign that I mentioned earlier. Much of our advertising there became in-state newspaper and radio, because it was very spontaneous trip generation that we were after there. And so that was very heavy marketing to Oregonians specifically. So there are a variety of programs, and in fact you'll note in the page that there are in the plan that there is a page that kind of takes a top-line approach that we call Marketing Oregon to Oregonians, and there's a page dedicated to that that kind of talks about the different programs that the Oregon Tourism Commission to do specifically that.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you think it's a good idea to put the sign again at the border, you are welcome to come and but don't stay, that will be any effect in the travel industry?
Mr. Chairman, I do think there would be an effect. My fear is that it wouldn't be the effect we may necessarily want to achieve. I can tell you from personal experience that when I have done trade shows in California, and I'm going back several years, but I had the opportunity 1 year to do trade shows in Sacramento, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. And what I learned is that the farther south I went, the more people remembered this what was felt to be an anti-California sentiment. You know, the folks in Sacramento were strongly aligned with Southern Oregon, and they loved coming to Oregon on vacations, and that sentiment had subsided. In San Francisco, I heard it a little bit. In L.A., you know, it felt like every fourth or fifth person by the booth was mentioning something about how we really didn't want them to come. And we've worked hard to overcome that. And my fear is that we may send the wrong message if we were to go back out. I think we need to send a very clear message to our visitors that they're welcome. Currently, the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department is using the tagline, come for a week, stay forever. And I think that's the very positive kind of message that we're learning about, is that people come here on vacation, they find out what a great place Oregon is to live, they begin wondering what it might be to be a place to work, maybe move their own corporation here, and therefore I am concerned about the effect we may have.
Okay, thank you for your comment. And could you explain a little bit what the Oregon Dream does?
That's it.
Sure. You know, we have an Oregon brand, Oregon Dreamer. Doesn't ring a bell to me. You know, maybe please expand.
Sure.
What it does,
sure.
And how it's going to bring the Oregon's image better.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the idea behind the Oregon We Love Dreamers campaign is that we believe that there are folks in Oregon that have kept and made Oregon an incredible place to live, work, and do business. And we want to celebrate that because we think that has an appeal as to what it is that makes Oregon unique. And so we're celebrating those individuals, those organizations, those initiatives through our campaign because there's an appeal there. It makes Oregon real. It makes it human. It adds a personal touch to, for example, what the Oregon chefs are doing or what the Oregon vintners are doing. Why is Oregon wine so special? Well, it's because of this personal connection that the vintners make. You know, what is it that makes the food so special? Well, it's about the chefs that actually get to know the growers, and the food is delivered fresh to their restaurant every day. What is it that makes Oregon's natural beauty so special? Well, it's about people that have done some things to, you know, maybe protect and preserve certain parts of the state as well. So the tagline as a standalone, while it may seem a little vague, is actually the right answer. And it's the exclamation point to the ads when you really look at them in context and look at what is it that makes Oregon special and unique. Oregon celebrates these individuals that have done tremendous things to make or keep Oregon the unique vacation destination that it is. We have found it to be very effective in the marketplace. We have found that it's resonating with our visitors. Our response rates are up. As I mentioned earlier, we were up 23% last year, just having the new revenue, the enhanced revenue for 6 months, we're up 23%. Already year to date this year, we're up 35%. We're finding this campaign has legs, and we're very eager to roll it out in an even stronger way during the next biennium.
Okay, I have several other questions, but I will limit my questions because this time is limited. And the one thing I'd like to ask you before we close this informational meeting, what is the new plan, different from the previous years, of the strategy that the between 5 and 7,
okay,
and that people can buy, be attracted to?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I could just to explore your question a little bit more. Is it that you're asking what's different in the 05-07 plan over what we've done in 03?
Yes, what's the new plan? What's the strategy? What I heard from this one is not much difference from the past many years. What is the striking differences? What's the new plan we can attract more visitors to our state?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the reasons you're hearing that we want to continue doing some of the things we're already doing is because it's working. We have found that we're generating a trip to Oregon for every $1.70 we spend in our media advertising programs. A recent campaign that we measured was about $350,000, and it generated over 220,000 trips to Oregon. If it's working, you know, it's the old, if it ain't broke, we don't want to, you know, don't fix it. If it's working, we just want to be able to funnel more money behind it. The biggest changes that you're seeing are more in how we're going to be rolling out some of these initiatives to actually package Oregon with our partners. In the past, for example, TravelOregon.com has been primarily a travel planning tool where you've been able to come and get some general information on your trip to Oregon. We actually have an opportunity now to put packages on our website where bed and breakfast in the wine country could actually put together an opportunity where you could fly into the state, stay at the bed and breakfast, visit the winery, have some meals, and that package could be put on our website. We can put it right there in front of the visitors when we already have their interest in planning their trip to Oregon. This is where it's becoming new. Are we still doing the website? Yes. But the way we're doing our website is vastly different. It's going to have a much stronger trip planning tool. We'll have much more dynamic content where our partners will be submitting content ideas. They'll be driving the database so that as folks come to our website and they say they're interested in fishing, let's say, we will be able to then connect them with places they could either go fishing, places that they could purchase their fishing gear, guides and packers that could take them out on the rivers and lakes to actually go fishing, and then we can also prompt them and say, you need lodging in this area. Are you looking for other activities in this area? So that they can start building their own package online as well. So really what you're going to see is a much more sophisticated deployment of some programs that have been very strong for us in the past. That is probably the most significant change that you will see in the 0507 biennium.
Right. Thank you very much. And my suggestion, proposal, that sometime in the future plan, we need to expand more direct international lines, but our state's population, 3.5 million populations, we don't have any critical mass in India. It may be if we reach 5 million people sometime in the next 10 years or more, we might be able to do that, but that there's international in that the flight is not the best compared to the Washington. Even Washington, we have Asian airline from there three times a week to the Korea. And then Korean airline also coming in three times a week beginning June. So almost every day from there to Korea. But in here, I just got back from Korea, but we gotta go through Japan, through the Northwest Airline, which I took last time. So we need to expand somehow international flight in the future, hopefully, with a strong leadership with the governor and with the U.S. And also, when I was in Japan with Governor Kitzhaber some time ago, they remember a film called Oregon with Love. And it has been shown in Japan many times, and they love it. Mm-hmm. When I said we are from Oregon, yeah, we saw the film, you know. That's a great impact. Mm-hmm. And so we are hoping to make such film and that so it could be impacted tourism quite a bit in the future. So, and the international guests coming from out of country, they are spending 2-3 times more dollars spent here than the travelers. So I hope we could play a big role in the future in the internationalism.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Points well made.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
With that, I know we might have several more questions, but because of the time, we are going to close a public hearing on the Oregon Tourism Plan for 2005-07. All right, and at this time, I'd like to open and House Bill 3307 first. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3307. And
Mr. Chairman, you want me to
What's the bill number?
This 3307 original bill eliminates the requirement that jobs made available to Jobs Plus program participants not displace regular employees, and The Dash 1 amendment from Representative Nelson restores the prohibition against using Jobs Plus employees to displace regular employees. It would allow Jobs Plus placements in positions that have been vacant for some time. You have also the Dash 2 amendment, which includes the Dash 1. The Dash 2 reauthorizes and extends the Job Plus program through the year 2012. and 2012. It limits referrals to job plus positions to those unemployment recipients who have received benefits for no more than 8 weeks and who have earned less than $15 per hour from the recipient's last employer. Mr. Chairman, we have a note. I don't know if you have a copy of the note from the drafter of the dash, the dash twos. And this is from Mr. Doug McKean, Deputy Legislative Counsel. This is attached to the dash two amendments to House Bill 3307. These amendments include the contents of House Bill 3462 and the dash one amendments to House Bill 3307. Mr. McKean goes on to say, I did not include an emergency clause in these amendments, so you'll see that difference between the amendments to 3307 and where they come from, House Bill 3462. He says, I did not include an emergency clause in these amendments, even though there is an emergency clause in House Bill 3462, and including emergency clause in that bill was a mistake because of the Oregon Constitution provisions, Section 1A, Article 9. States that an emergency clause may not be declared, this is a quote, in any act regulating taxation or exemption, unquote. And since House Bill 3307 with these amendments will regulate taxation, that emergency clause has not been included.
All right. Thank you very much. And who should I call? First, I'd like to call the Employment Department, Tamara Brickman. And there's two persons.
Yes, why don't you call Tamara?
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to call at this time Tamara Brickman from the Employment Department. And also, would you like to come alone or would you like to, do you have someone else with you? You are the only one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Tamara, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And I had not planned on providing testimony, but am here to answer questions about the provisions of the bill, should you have any questions.
All right. Any questions from, yes, Vice Chair Moakley?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Tamara, I'd like to understand it's my impression is under the dash 2 amendment that there would be a charge of approximately $88 million to the unemployment fund, and that this would trigger a change in taxes or might trigger a change in taxes. Could you help us understand that issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, the provisions in the Dash 2 amendments establish a $106 million diversion from the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund to be placed into the Jobs Plus Unemployment Wage Fund. And so essentially you just divert away about $106 million over the next 12 years from the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. The diversion schedule that I understand that's in the Dash 2 amendments would take about $12 million in diversion per year. And because there are a few things in play here, and that is the House and Senate and is now law passed a unemployment insurance extension bill in House Bill 3305. And there is a bill that is should be coming law that will reduce unemployment insurance taxes. So our current projections without House Bill 3462, without the Jobs Plus bill, show that employers would get a rate reduction of about $200 million. If House Bill 3462 is passed and you divert money within the next 2 years, employers will, rather than getting a full rate reduction that we are projecting, won't get the full rate reduction and will actually collect $88 million more than we currently anticipate collecting under the reduction bill because there's a very slim margin. I don't know if I did justice to that with respect to the explanation.
If I can follow up.
Yes, follow up.
So just to clarify, are you saying the entire 200 is wiped out plus of reductions plus another $88 million? No.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Berkeley, no. It reduces that reduction. It reduces the tax reduction that employers will receive.
And it reduces it to $88 million?
It reduces it to approximately $200 million minus $89 million. Dollars.
Okay, so to $112.
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, with that, if that then has an impact on the tax rate that would need to be charged to employers?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, currently projecting the passage of House Bill 2127, which is in the Senate Commerce Committee and is scheduled for work session tomorrow afternoon, projecting the passage of that, the Employment Department projects that in calendar year 2007 and calendar year 2008, we would go to Schedule 3. We are currently in Schedule 5. If House Bill 3462 is passed, we would go to Schedule 4 rather than 3, and we would collect in Schedule 4 $88 million more from employers than we would otherwise collect in Schedule 3.
Okay. If I can...
Yes.
Follow up. Can you these are big numbers in this fund, so I want to get a sense of the proportion. Is there a per hour rate or a percentage increase that translates to?
We don't do a per hour rate, but the $88 million, if we were to collect in Schedule 4 as opposed to Schedule 3, we would collect approximately that $88 million represents a 15.5% increase in the amount we currently project to collect without House Bill 3462 or the Jobs Plus program.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Okay. Chairman.
I'd like to call at this time the Deborah Lincoln, too, in case if you want to interject any questions we might ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tamara's doing great.
All right.
If there are other individuals who, I guess, were in private, owned their own business now looking for a job, can they be placed through this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of your question because I didn't hear very well. I apologize.
That's all right. I couldn't follow you either. So we're equal. Individuals who own their own business, for example, that are now no longer an owner of McDonald's. Mm-hmm. If they need a job because they need desperately to learn a new skill, can they be placed through this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it would depend on whether or not they were eligible for unemployment insurance in the first place. And if you are a true independent contractor or a business owner, and you're most likely not covered by unemployment insurance. So in order to get placed under the Jobs Plus program, you have to be an eligible unemployment insurance recipient. So I would say an owner of a McDonald's restaurant would not be eligible for unemployment insurance because they most likely are not paying taxes on themselves, but they are paying taxes on their employees.
Okay. And follow up, Mr. Chair. And as far as independent contractor, what do you mean? A painter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there is a definition of independent contractor in Oregon law and under federal law. And for unemployment insurance purposes, you're either an employee or an independent contractor. So if you meet the definition of the independent contractor statute in Oregon law, then you would not be covered by unemployment insurance.
So that's basically the same as this business owner.
Pretty much. If you are free from direction and control and also have an independently established business, you are an independent contractor.
And a last question, please, Mr. Chair. So out of the individuals who come to the employment agency for jobs, what percentage of them fall into that category of not able to, I guess, be placed in this type of program? Is it 2%, 1%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't have the overall percentage at the top of my head. I can get back to you this afternoon with what the percentage of covered workers are in the state of Oregon, those workers that are eligible for unemployment insurance versus those workers who are not. I don't have those numbers on the top of my head, but I'd be happy to get back to you.
What do you suppose it would be right now?
I hate to venture a guess, but I would say that we probably have a 85% coverage rate in the state of Oregon.
So you think 15% of the individuals who come to the employment agency for jobs are not entitled to benefits, unemployment
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think we're talking about two things. What we're talking about are people who are out of work and receiving unemployment through the insurance program, which their employers have paid into, versus people who simply walk in the door looking for a job, either a first job, a higher level job, some kind of new job, whether they're employed or unemployed. So the unemployment claimants that we're talking about are the only ones who are eligible for the Jobs Plus program. Anyone else who walks in the door, whether they are unemployed or employed but not are not UI claimants, cannot participate in the Jobs Plus program.
And I just want to add to that, but they do receive services. They will receive job search services, and we will help them in a job search. We have this wonderful tool that we just started, as a matter of fact, that I've been trying to schedule to get you to actually see the demonstration called iMatch Skills, in which employers can now place job orders through the Employment Department online to place not only claimants, but anybody in the state of Oregon looking for work, and anybody in the state of Oregon can also, individuals looking for work, can utilize that program to find employment for themselves as well.
Yes.
Vice Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up a little bit on Representative Nelson's question. So if I've been freshly out of high school, or if I've been studying in college and drop out to work, if, assuming I had been in high school and not working, and or in college and not working, would I be eligible for this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, you're only eligible if you're eligible for unemployment insurance, and typically, and I'm just saying in a typical case, if you have been in school and are unemployed after being in school and you don't have requisite work history to qualify for unemployment insurance, then no, you would not be eligible, because you would not be eligible for a claim. You have to, in order to be eligible for unemployment insurance, you have to have a work history in order to establish what we call base year wages to actually determine what your claim level would be. So if you're coming right from high school with no work experience, or college with no work experience within the last year and a half, you're not going to qualify for unemployment insurance benefits.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So if I'm a stay-at-home spouse and I decide to re-enter the workforce, I want to ask about that question. I gather the answer is no, but I just want to double-check. Or what if I was eligible, but my benefits expired? My benefits lasted period X, but now it's another year past that. I'm still looking for work. Would I be eligible for Jobs Plus?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, no, you would not. You have to be a current recipient of unemployment insurance, and as the Dash 2 amendments would require, we could only place you in a Jobs Plus job if you were within the first 8 weeks of your unemployment insurance claim.
Within the first 8 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I would appreciate.
Excuse me, but I just want to say there is also an exception in there that would allow the Employment Department to place 10% of Jobs Plus recipients outside of that 8-week claim. So 10% of the unemployment insurance recipients in the Jobs Plus program could be outside of that 8-week claim, but 90% of people that we are going to be placing have to be within the first 8 weeks of their claim.
Okay. And one last question here, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Going back, when you talked about the 15.5%. Increase in the taxes, I'm assuming that such a tax would then have a reverberation back in the economy. How would that tax affect jobs that are available, number of jobs that are available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, as I know you are all very aware, because you deal with this on a daily basis, tax increases do have a definite effect on the economy. And in order to kind of determine what the effect would be if in a raise in unemployment insurance taxes, our actuary contacted Mazen Malik at the Office of Legislative Revenue to ask. They have a model that they can utilize to determine how much tax increases will affect the economy. He anticipated that if you raise unemployment insurance taxes by about $100 million, that would result in a loss of 1,000 jobs in Oregon.
And in this case, it's about $90 million, but that's close enough for this type of.
He estimated on the $100 million mark, so I mean it would be close to 1,000 jobs.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Nelson.
Yes, Tamara, I thought there was a surplus. I thought you had a surplus.
Mr. Chair,
why are we talking about raising taxes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there's not a surplus in the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. What we did was, it's a self-adjusting mechanism. We have to maintain a certain level of money in the trust fund to pay benefits for 18 months at a certain unemployment rate. And what we have taken a look at is the fact that that formula was established in the early 80s and hasn't been reviewed. And we believe that we have been, our trust fund has been so healthy that we could reduce that level of reserve that we are required in law to maintain in the trust fund. So it's not a question of surplus. It's a question of how much we keep in reserve to pay benefits for a year and a half if we're at a certain recessionary level. So we believe we can reduce that amount and thus not collect as much money from employers so that they can keep the money in their businesses and spend the money in their businesses rather than having money held in a trust fund to pay unemployment insurance benefits. So we believe that reducing the formula to collect less money and still maintain solvency of the trust fund to pay benefits for 18 months at a certain recessionary level was the wise thing to do so that employers were keeping some of their money.
Okay, call it a surplus, call it excess reserve, whatever. How much is that? What is that amount?
How much is the, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, how much is the balance of the trust fund?
Mm-hmm.
The balance of the trust fund, I think, as of the end of last week, was right around $1.3 to $1.4 billion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, any question? Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically what I understand from this is that if we continue this program, what basically how it works is all the employers in the state in their unemployment insurance payments pay for the jobs that we're subsidizing for these employers. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, correct. All employers that are subject to unemployment insurance payroll taxes pay this tax. So 100% of employers would pay the tax that would provide the money for the Jobs Plus Fund. And our data indicates that less than 2% of employers over the last 4 years have utilized the program for that. So essentially, yes, you have approximately 98% or 100% of employers or you have 2% using the money that 100% are paying for.
Thank you.
All right. I have a few questions. How much does it cost to run this program? What's the administrative cost?
Mr. Chairman, microphone doesn't like me. We need about a third of the amount of the total program to run it. In the last the year that we gave you on our sheet, it runs from July 1 to November 30th, so it's a little more than a year. We spent just about $6 million total on the program. Over $1.7 million of that went to administration, which is about 30%. But over the 4 years of this recent program, we spent 33% of the appropriation on program and administrative costs. That's because we have staff around the state. It's a very staff-intensive program. We have to identify and match people to the right jobs. The biggest limiting factor to this program is finding a new job, an employer who has a new job with a training component to it, and then matching up somebody. So it's fairly staff intensive, and the costs run about 33%.
So approximately, if it's $60 million, it's 33%, about one-third, which means about the out of $60 million, spend almost $2 million to run this program.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And it seems to me very high cost to run this program. Yes, and
I agree. That's why we don't support the program.
Okay, and don't kill the messenger if this is a program cost too high in running this program, then we need to change somehow how could we reduce the administrative cost. And when I look at the administrative cost of a lottery, they spend about 6%. And that's a pretty good running. This is running in the one-third of the cost running this program. I couldn't accept that amount is running cost that much. I know this is a labor-intensive program, but it looks like too much. Is there any way you can reduce this program if this programs continue?
Mr. Chairman, we have had 10 years experience in this program and 4 years most recently in the current program. I don't like to say no, but I think we are being very, very upfront about saying that, no, we cannot reduce these costs. In fact, if we were to implement the program as was described in 3462, we would need to add to the administrative costs. We don't have the ability currently to do any kind of auditing of the employers who use these or the kinds of jobs. And so we suspect and have some pretty good evidence that there's churning going on, that people are not creating new jobs but are filling existing jobs. But we have no way to audit that. So I would very strongly recommend, if we continue this program, that we have some kind of audit function, which would increase the cost. Also, the bill as written calls for 4,000 placements a year. We are barely making 2,000 a year now. It's a 40% placement rate. That is, an employer will place a Jobs Plus listing with us and then choose not to fill it. And we only place about 40% of those listings. So we would have to develop 10,000 job listings in order to make 4,000 placements a year, which would require much, much more intensive job development and work with employers, which again would cost quite a bit more money than we're already spending. So, Mr. Chair, I sympathize with the interest in getting the program costs down on this, but I have to be very, very honest and say, no, I don't think we can reduce it anymore. This is a very, very staff-intensive program. None of the proponents, none of the employers, nobody has come to us with any ideas about how we might reduce those costs beyond what we have looked at. So I think the biggest reason we think this program should not go forward is because it's staff-intensive, it costs too much, and it's very ineffective.
Right. And so how many people that employed, particularly for this program, how many people have been working on this program in the past, if not now?
In the employment department, we had 23 full-time equivalent staff assigned to this job. This past biennium, when some of the Jobs Plus money was diverted to the general fund, we reduced that by 2 FTE. So we're down to about 18 or 19 FTE. That includes people in field offices, and we have 49 field offices across the state. So we break those up. Some people are working part-time on this program. That includes an accountant in the business services office to provide the payments and track the payments to employers, and it includes a little bit of administrative oversight. What it does not include is the time that most of the central staff spends on this program. Tamara, for example, has worked on this program in terms of the legislative kinds of things. I've worked on it. We have an awful lot of data people who've been developing data for the people who are interested in the program. None of them has charged their time to the Jobs Plus program. So the administrative costs are really understated.
All right. And so if this, for instance, if this Jobs Plus program goes away, what happened to the people working over there now, about the 20 to 23 people?
Mr. Chairman, we anticipated this. As vacancies come up, we have not filled them. We brought on a couple of temporary people to finish out the program until the end of the biennium. But by June 30th, those positions will be gone, and they are not authorized in our budget request as on a go-forward basis. So through attrition, we have eliminated those positions.
And Vice Chair Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincoln, I know you testified on this before. I know it's more of a work session than a hearing, but if you could address and briefly would be best the alternatives to Jobs Plus. And what I'm specifically referring to are training and education alternatives. And could you address that in both in terms of efficiency, i.e., cost, you know, the cost of administrative programs, as well as effectiveness, you know, getting these people permanently in the workforce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bruin, there are a number of alternatives. We starting with simply placing claimants and getting them off the unemployment insurance rolls. We do a number of claimant reemployment programs and efforts. We look at claimants at the fourth week and again at their eighth week, and if they're not successful in finding a job or not looking for a job, if they're not looking for a job, they are their benefits are taken away. But we bring them in, work with them one-on-one to get them registered in our iMatch skills program, match them up with jobs, send them on interviews. So it's a fairly intensive case management kind of effort, and we do that in varying degrees of intensity depending on the economy in the local area, who's unemployed, what the jobs are available, and those kinds of things. There is, in fact, we have had for the last couple of years a federal grant specifically for claimant reemployment that has allowed us to put a couple of people on in the field to do this more intense claimant reemployment. We also are part of the overall Oregon WorkSource system, the workforce system that includes community colleges, the former JTBA folks, under the Workforce Investment Act, vocational rehabilitation, TANF, a whole a bunch of both public and private partners who come together in co-located areas around the state, one stops, many of them in our field offices, that allow us to work with people who can provide more intensive services than we do. So if somebody walks in the door who is not labor ready, doesn't have the skills necessary to transition into a new career, a new job, we are able to hook those folks up with community college partners, with private training, a whole variety of services through the one-stop workforce system to get them into the job. Because this is available across the board to anybody who walks into our offices, and the economies of scale are much, much greater than Jobs Plus, it's really a much more efficient way to get people into jobs. We're also able to focus our training efforts and our recruitment efforts on those kinds of industries and jobs that either are or lead to family wage jobs and a true career rather than low wage the kind of grocery store box boy kinds of jobs that we're seeing a lot of in Jobs Plus. So we can focus and target our energies and our money, a lot of it Workforce Investment Act, federal money, to really getting people into jobs that are going to improve the economy and not simply churn over and over and over.
Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As I understand it, the type of jobs that we're trying to place folks into through Jobs Plus are not a seasonal job or a temporary job, but one that is a new job and anticipated that it will be there throughout the year, throughout the next year. Is my understanding correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, the ideal and the thought behind this program was very good. The ideal job would be a company that sees an opportunity in the market, would like to hire additional staff people, create new jobs, but can't quite do it based on the economics of that company. So we would provide them with someone with some level of skill who would go into this brand new job for 13 weeks, receive substantial training, and then be available to that industry or that company for ongoing permanent jobs, and eventually that job could turn into a permanent one. That's the ideal, and in a couple of companies it has worked. Gunderson, for example, has used it very effectively that way. That's not the way that we're seeing it happen in most companies, though.
So why are temp agencies involved in this process? Are they filling temporary jobs? Are they filling permanent jobs on behalf of companies? How does this whole temp agency role work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, since there's a temp agency in the room, you might want to ask that. It's hard for me to say. We don't have the audit ability to track through and see what all these jobs are. We do know of one temp agency, for example, and it's not the one in the room, who uses some of the jobs plus jobs that they get for their own organization, that is within their own office areas, and others that they then contract out to their own clients, so that would be a third party contract. Several of those, as we look at anecdotally at the list of jobs that temp agencies are filling with jobs plus jobs, look to be a temporary and seasonal. For example, one of the temp agencies sent a number of people to Cirque du Soleil when they came to town to set up circus tents. That's not something that's probably something that's going to turn into an ongoing job. It was a temporary job, a temporary need. Cirque du Soleil would have hired those folks anyway, whether they got a subsidy from us or not. But they the temporary agency gave them jobs plus jobs, which were then subsidized to set up circus tents.
Mr. Chair, is that sort of thing, sending people with temporary jobs like Cirque du Soleil setting up tents, was that done in violation of the program outlines, or that's allowed under the program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, the program guidelines don't, and the statute don't allow us to question that, and again, the amount of money that we have to spend for administration doesn't allow us to audit. So, they can do as long as they are new jobs, they're not displacing anybody, they're not jobs that have been filled and are now vacant. They are supposed to have some kind of training component to them. We again are not able to audit to ensure that there is training component, though. Every employer who lives with us has to describe some kind of training component.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, who is Hire calling?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, it is a staffing agency, and representatives of Hire calling are in the room. So
why would we be sending the majority of our people to them if we're spending 33% in overhead? It seems strange that, you know, half of the people go to Hire calling, but yet our agency's charging 33%.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I agree. It is not a good use of the money, and it may be. I don't want to speak for Hire calling since they are in the room. They may be able to tell you more about how they use the program and whether it's appropriate.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Who is SITEL?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, it is a high-tech company. I'm not sure what kind of jobs they use. We'll have to get back to you on that, but it is a high-tech company.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I believe they staff calling centers, but I will again double-check on that and give you a call.
Okay. Well, my point, if I could, Mr. Chair, is, you know, these opportunities that get people in the door, and I see a company that I started here on your top 15 jobs, employers, jobs plus employers, Evergreen Eagle. And, nobody else would ever have that opportunity because there's no other ground handling company that operates at major airports around the world, as a matter of fact. So these individuals that go to that company, I mean, they're getting a skill that there's nowhere. There's no college degree for this. This is it. And, having built those bases myself, I know that. And then I see Forest River, which is an incredible opportunity in Dallas for in the mobile home business, a brand new company that just now is, those people are going to have opportunities that they never would have had any other place. So I'm just sad that I keep hearing such negativism. I see a lot of companies on here that I would expect to see, like a Gerald Wynn and Nike's and other major
corporations, I don't know why they're not on here. I'm curious.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, there are some good examples of people who do get skills. There's a good question of whether those companies who provide that kind of on-the-job training for skills that can't be gained anyplace else would have done that anyway without a job subsidy. I don't know. Possibly not, but I think the one reason why you don't see the Nikes and the Columbia Sportswears and even the Jeldwins, and again, Higher Calling has some connections to Jeldwin, so they can speak for Jeldwin, is because those companies don't need or don't ask for or don't believe they should be taking a government subsidy in order to fill their jobs and train their future workforce. So you're absolutely right. The people who went to Evergreen, to Forest River, probably did get skills that they couldn't get anyplace else. The question is, big picture, are there enough people taking advantage of this program, enough businesses involved to justify the kind of tax increase? That is, if, for example, if Forest River had to pay increased taxes in order to get their jobs subsidized through the Jobs Plus program, are they paying more taxes than the subsidy they're getting? Would it have been better for them to keep those taxes in their pocket, reinvest in their own business, and go ahead and hire those folks and train them on the job, and then come out ahead? I don't know. That's a question to be considered.
Follow it, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Deborah, I and Tamara, I do not understand why either one of you are talking about an increased tax. This is making me insane this morning. There's something haywire here.
And this
we've got huge reserves like this, and you're all of a sudden you've turned this job plus program into a big fat tax increase. I know you don't like the program. Why don't you contract it out to private enterprise, and I bet you they can run it for less than 33%. Have you tried that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the question is, how do you pay for this program? Whether you contract it out to private enterprise or whether government employees do it, it has to be paid for. The reason that there will be a tax increase is because our trust fund has a self-adjusting mechanism. So if you take money out of the reserves, it drops it below the statutory benchmark, and you have to bump up into a higher tax schedule in order to get the reserves up back up to that benchmark. We've lowered the benchmark through House Bill 2127, which is where the $200 million tax savings come from. But once you start dropping that even lower, you get the reserve down below the statutory benchmark, which automatically kicks the tax schedules back into the higher schedules, and that's where the tax increase comes. So it's a balance. You can either not lower that benchmark, leave more money in the tax reserves, and then divert it to provide funding for other kinds of programs, including Jobs Plus, whether it's private sector or public sector. Or you can allow the reserves to drop so far below the benchmark that you are in danger of bankrupting your trust fund, which a number of states did this past recession and had to borrow to pay unemployment insurance benefits. Or you can allow the benchmark to stay at the 2127 level, siphon off more money to pay for this program or lots of other programs, have employers then kick up into higher tax schedules in order to backfill that money.
But could I ask for an answer, Mr. Chair? Have you tried to contract this out? So Chair Lim asked, can we bring that 33% down? And have you sent out bids, RFPs, to see if it's possible?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, no, we haven't. The statute, of course, requires us to operate it. We'd have to work with the federal government to see if this money could be used in that way. We could always check that out. But again, we have not done it.
Okay. Is the chair's intention that the hopefully continue this program, and then there are so many unanswered questions in this matter. So during the interim, I'm hoping to have some kind of a work group to find out how the program has been working, and this is a good program to continue or just to scrap it. And so I think it's timely for us to come up, and with the one or two public hearings, we're not going to have a full answer on this matter. So let's consider that as a one option. And also the option is hopefully they privatize it, might be run better. We don't know at this point. So do the study this coming interim, and then we might be able to find some of the answers. The question I have, a very important question I have, I just want to find out how much it will cost from the employment, unemployment insurance, mm-hmm. the cost per person in a period of 3 months or 6 months, whatever we have, or average, okay? Mm-hmm. And how much will it cost to pay the person for the job lost during the period of months? And then how much will it cost to run this program, the Jobs Plus program? I just want to find out the justification, whether it's good for paying money. And how many months usually do they get? 3 months or extension to 5 months? How many months are they getting paid?
Mr. Chair, the program with respect to paying them provides up to 13 weeks worth of a $5 subsidy for 40 hours a week. So an employer could utilize the subsidy.
I'm talking about the person unemployed, claiming for the unemployment insurance.
Oh,
yes.
We can give you an average duration of benefits. I can give
yes.
you, right now I can tell you that of claimants that we see that are not attached, and I don't want to explain what attached and unattached means unless you have questions, but those people who don't have a definite return to work date are considered unattached claimants. They're
yes.
not affiliated with a union hall or anything. That's about 40% of our population of unemployment insurance recipients. Of that percentage, of that 40% of unattached claimants, 53% of those people are on benefits for less than 8 weeks.
Okay. So how much is the approximate
It depends on the average benefit amount.
The average.
They vary, but the average benefit amount we're dealing with at this point in time is about $252 a week.
A week. I'm talking about the total the cost during the many months, 13 weeks, whatever.
I'll work with you, Chairlin, to kind of clarify the questions a little bit and see what data you're asking for, and I'd be happy to provide
yes.
you with that.
Yes, so my point, the cost of this Running Jobs Plus program and the cost paying them out of the unemployment insurance cost,
mm-hmm.
and try to find out what is the best way to handle the situation, just paying them out of the unemployment insurance, or should we give them some training program such as a Jobs Plus program?
I understand the question.
And so without that answer, it is very difficult to determine whether this program is good or bad. We need that information.
Okay.
And the second question I have, concerning the employer, do they have any the program overutilizing? And it's happened to be the welfare program for the employer, in a simple word. And I just want to find out whether this program has been working well, or when they hired under this Jobs Plus program, or they've been hired permanently, or laid them off, and then bring them back again under this program again. I'd like to know that issue also. Without having that knowledge, it is very difficult to come up that good judgment on this issue.
Mr. Chair, we have some data on job retention overall, not necessarily with that particular employer, the Jobs Plus employer, but we have a comparison of job retention for claimants, unemployment insurance claimants who do not receive Jobs Plus, that receive direct placement services from us, versus retention rates for Jobs Plus participants 1 year after placement in a job, and I have that data I can provide to you.
Okay, so I'd like to have the cost analysis of those or the programs you have, so we have some information on it, so could make a good decision on this issue.
Okay.
Are there any other questions from our members here? Okay, if not, and please stand by though. Thank you very much at this time. And I'd like to call at this time Mark King. And he's a one person.
Do you have any
other person with you to testify?
Mr. Chairman, John Courtney is here. With
yes, John, come on in.
And I believe Lisa Trussell from ALI was going to make some comments, but I think she had to leave, and I'll tell you about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Who's going to start first? Mark, are you going to start?
I'll start, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. You heard some of the questions we raised, and if you incorporate our questions in your remarks, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Courtney has been taking copious notes, and I think intends to respond to most of those questions. Chairman Lim and members of the committee, thank you for today's opportunity to testify before you in behalf of House Bill what is now 3307, and it's my understanding that the bill is to be amended to include the elements of House Bill 3462, which would reauthorize the Jobs Plus program for 8 years. I testified before you last week and submitted written testimony. I will not repeat that, but would like to add to it briefly. The chairman of the Klamath Lake Jobs Plus Advisory Council wasn't able to be here today. He did accompany me to some of the other hearings, but asked me to convey to you his strong support of reauthorizing the Jobs Plus program for unemployment claimants. He's very active, by the way, with the chambers of commerce across the state, and just this week he initiated a one-question survey of the state's chambers. The question was simply, should the Jobs Plus program be authorized? Within 48 hours, 21 different chambers responded, 100% of them with a yes. Employer support is broad. I have submitted with my testimony a list of those chambers for your reference. The chambers were also surveyed in another 5-question survey aimed at understanding if employers were aware of the availability of the Jobs Plus program. And if so, would they utilize the program? 42 employers responded almost immediately, and more responses are coming in. 60% answer the question if they've ever heard of the program with a no. More than half indicated they would hire more employees if the program were available. More than 60% indicated that the $5 per hour subsidy would stimulate them to hire someone right away. The point of this survey was to confirm that the program has wide appeal and strong support. Last week, I shared with you my experience visiting participants in my community. And you remember the lady from Diamond Supply, perhaps, that I talked about, that is still on the job 2 years now, and she mentors new Jobs Plus participants. This week, I visited on the phone with employers who have participated in the Jobs Plus program. Just this week, we talked to nearly 350 employers all over the state that have participated in the Jobs Plus program. And I'm pleased to report to you that this recent survey confirms the results that we have reported to you earlier, that 96% of employers that have utilized this program would like to see it renewed. In fact, the percentage may have risen to as much as 99%. Many of these employers indicated that they would be calling their members of this committee to encourage your support. As an example, one particular employer, and I'm glad this came up at the committee, and it did at the Consumer Affairs Committee last week, the question came up as to who is Sitel. Sitel is in Hillsboro. Representative Riley probably knows of them. That's your area. Last Wednesday, in another House committee, I was asked about this company because it is reportedly one of the top 15 users of the program. Here's what I found out about Sitel. They are a customer call center employing 800 personnel. They hire in at $10 an hour, promote quickly to $11, and pay $12 an hour after 90 days with benefits. They strongly support the program and suggested they would be calling in with their support.
Representative from Sitel, other companies and participants will be testifying in behalf of reauthorization when testimony is heard in the Senate. In my 32 years of experience in development and administration of employment programs for people with all kinds of challenges, I find this type of program to be remarkable. Researchers agree. Last week, I shared with you the research relating to the devastating effects that unemployment has on employees, their families, and their communities, and the very positive impacts that employment has. This week, I would like to share briefly a different piece of research. Released just this last month was a review of a new compendium of long-term research results on job training published by the Upjohn Institute's Employment Research Journal. Here's some of the results. Job training effectiveness varies widely with respect to different demographic groups of participants. The biggest gains were observed when on-the-job training was combined with job search assistance. The bottom line, evaluation studies have found that combining work experience with job training tends to produce better labor market success. And that is what Jobs Plus is. The Jobs Plus program should remain in the department's toolbox along with others that prove themselves to be efficient and effective. In a state that regularly leads the nation in unemployment, this isn't a time to kill a successful reemployment program. Last week, I stressed the significance of the more than 7,000 people employed by Jobs Plus since its last reauthorization and the impact not just on them, but their families. This week, I will simply note the large numbers of people who remain unemployed in the state of Oregon. 1 in 10 employees will become unemployed and receive benefits. Benefits that could otherwise be utilized to train them on the job with greater earnings than their benefits might have been. In fact, nearly twice as much as wages than benefits. 40,000 unemployment claimants a year have exhausted their benefits after 6 months or as many as 9 months. The proposed reauthorization of the Jobs Plus program would allow us to serve 1 in 10 of those exhaustees, not to mention other claimants as well. Questions were raised about the cost, Mr. Chairman, and since you asked me to respond to some of this, let me give just a quick, I think, and simple example. $252 was given as the average benefit claim per week. So you're moving along here at 8 weeks at $252. At 8 weeks, we suggest you move to a job and your benefits discontinue. The employer gets $5 an hour at 40 hours a week for 13 weeks. That's $200 a week. The department reports that the administrative cost is $666. The remaining $52 on the table times 13 is $676. So we save $10 per week during that period. There is additional savings beyond that of all the benefits that have not been claimed or wouldn't be claimed then while the person continues in employment and now the program's ended. And if that person would have collected that extended benefit we just authorized of 6.5 weeks, that's a whole lot more money that might be saved. That's just a simple, I think, explanation, but I think it gets to the essence of the subject. Also on the subject of auditing, I'll let John address that issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee for your attention. I did want to pass on one other thing. Did Mrs. Trussell come back in the room? Mrs. Trussell said that she would have to be at another meeting and asked me to report to you that the AOI does, that she represents, does support reauthorization. Their executive board did vote unanimously in favor of the reauthorization earlier this year.
Okay.
Also, I did pass out to you not only the testimony I just read, but the talking piece that we've been using throughout the session, similar with notes on the back. And I did distribute to you the testimony that I presented to the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee last week on House Bill 3462.
All right. And, okay, John.
Thank you, Chair Lynn, committee members. I I'm encouraged. There are quite a few questions here this morning, and I think I've got a lot of good information to answer quite a few of them for you. I'll try to answer the ones that were asked by the people in the room right now. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondered if he could identify himself and who he's with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
Thank you for reminding me.
My name is John Courtney, and I am with a company called Higher Calling Public Affairs.
Could you explain to us that from you, who and what is the Higher Calling? What are they associated with?
Yes, Chairman, committee members. Higher Calling is a staffing company, otherwise known as a temp agency. The term in industry has moved to staffing companies because in the past it used to be more temporary type jobs. These days, and I'll tell you, Higher Calling Public Affairs is a sister company of Higher Calling, the staffing company. And there's been some discussion about staffing companies and how they participate in the program here. I can tell you that Higher Calling is a company that was purchased about 4.5 years ago, and by Mr. Wendt, who is involved with Geldwin. Mr. Wendt and some of the Geldwin folks have been working on full employment for clearly a little bit over 20 years. In the past decade, he has funded and operated a nonprofit organization called the American Institute for Full Employment. That institute consults across the nation on full employment issues and workforce services. We do an awful lot of research, and we try to make sure that we're current with what's happening and best practices across the nation. Higher Calling, as a staffing company, was purchased by Mr. Wendt because he felt that he was doing as much as he could in the nonprofit arena, but he felt that he needed to get directly involved in the business of helping people get jobs. So after 20 years of working on concepts and ideas and after 10 years of operating in a nonprofit, he decided to add a little more of his reserves to try to help. And that's why I also participate in that company, and that's why we operate that company.
Okay, so do you believe that the Higher Calling connected with the Geldwin has a direct interest of this Jobs Plus program?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, I can tell you, I recall when we had made the purchase of the staffing company, and the question was for the staffing company branch managers, would you be willing to support this program and actively help promote it? And there was a little bit of reticence, I can tell you, in the field. It was mostly, it's something new. We're going to have to deal with government and maybe some bureaucracy. We're not sure whether this is something we want to do. I can tell you statewide, our branches have embraced it. And they see as part of their mission in helping their communities, helping the people they know are not finding job opportunities. These are people who come in the doors trying to find work, who they can't connect up with an employer. They've seen the benefit of being able to provide this employer directly with a subsidy to help them get that job. And I can tell you what, it makes our branch managers feel good. And if you ask the employment department managers in the field and the ones who are making replacements, resoundingly they've said the same thing. They're very happy. They like helping people.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to tag on to that, if I could. I've talked with Jamie Madden, the president of Higher Calling Staffing, and he participates in a trade association of staffing companies across the state. He's taken time out to present to others at the trade association, his competitors, if you will, about the Jobs Plus program and how to use the program. And you'll see on the list that I think that the department has distributed to you all of the 15 top users, three or four other staffing companies that have been encouraged by Mr. Madden to use this program to put people to work. Some people suggest that there's some abuse here. We believe that it's not abuse, it's simply good leadership, and we're encouraging other people to use the program to put people to work because we believe it's important.
Right, and Representative Nelson?
Yes, I wanted to ask John, out of the 419 Jobs Plus employees that Higher Calling hired, how many of those went to Geldwin to learn how to put in windows and doors? And I do appreciate Geldwin, they're one of the best citizens of our state, and I appreciate Mr. Wendt's concern.
I'm sorry. Representative Nelson, Chair Lim, committee members. The numbers that I've seen suggest that Gerald Wendt over the past 4 years has made no hires at all. If they have made hires through hire calling, I haven't been able to get those numbers from the Employment Department. The report that we found showed zero hires altogether from Gerald Wendt. And we find ourselves caught in sort of a difficult position. You're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. If you participate in the program and help people get employed, you're abusing it and using it. And if you don't, maybe you're ignoring it, not supporting it.
Follow up. So where else will they learn how to put in windows and doors? I look at all these 15 here, and I don't know, you don't learn any of this in college. I have a master's degree, three different pretty large careers in my life. I would have never learned aviation anywhere in this, in college here in the state, except you could get an A&P mechanics license and a pilot license. That's it. Nothing in management. And they're on here. And I see all these. Nothing teaches you how to work in you don't get a degree in parking. You don't get to learn how to manage parking facilities. You don't get a degree in how to handle the customer at Safeway. I'm just curious. Your competitors on here, LBL Windows.
Mm-hmm.
So for Gerald Wendt not to be on here when, you started this company kind of seems strange to me. But anyway, why is this program 33%? Why is it so expensive to run? It seems so strange.
Great. Representative Nelson, Chair Lim, committee members, it's a great question. I'm not sure, but I have some very specific ideas. One is that this program has operated in the state for quite some time. You may know it was a voter initiative back in 91. It went on a trial basis and was so successful it went statewide. It's been operating for about a decade, very successfully on all counts. The administrative numbers we looked at 4 years ago when we had a thorough study of those numbers showed that it was about $444 per placement. They've climbed to about $666 per placement. I was told yesterday that they might be even north of that. That's an over 50% increase in cost. So I draw a few conclusions from that and one other fact. The first conclusion I draw is that we can bring administrative costs down. We've done it. We operated it 4 years ago quite successfully at a lower cost. Number two is that this program was carved back by about a third in the number of placements 4 years ago. So it was running up a little bit over 3,000 placements per year. And the trend line was heading very quickly to 4,000. When we carved it back by about 50%, administration costs went up by 50%. And for those of you who worked in business or other management areas, you'll know that there are economies of scale in these types of things. I suspect that's a big part of it.
Vice Chair Mulkey.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kane,
yes.
I'd like to clarify the survey you took. Did you distinguish between the Jobs Plus Health and Human Services Program versus Jobs Plus Unemployment Insurance Program when you took that survey?
I believe we did, yes, sir.
Could you provide us with the questions, the text of the questions as they were asked?
I think I can, yes.
Okay, that would be very helpful. So you think employers, in talking about whether or not Jobs Plus should continue, do we know if they were talking about the Jobs Plus Health and Human Services versus talking about Jobs Plus Unemployment Insurance?
I'll have to be very straightforward with you. I was not directly involved in doing the survey, so I'm not entirely certain about all of the questions you're asking, but I can provide the samples of the survey for you to look at if you like.
That would be great.
Chair Lim, may I respond?
Yes, we'd like to have the copy each one of the sources.
Certainly. And you represented Markley, Chair Lim. The vast majority of placements in the program right now and for the past 4 years have been on the unemployment insurance side. Mark, I'm sure we'll get you the answers on how the survey was conducted, but you should just know that the majority of activity out there and visibility of the program or awareness of the program is all on the unemployment insurance side at this stage.
Another concern I'd like you to address, Mr. Kane, is with this amendment, someone who is in their first week 8 weeks of unemployment will be potentially subsidized to an employer, while someone who is outside of that framework or is coming back into the workforce, having been a spouse, coming out of high school, coming out of college, taking a leave from college, will be unsubsidized. There's something that bothers me about pitting these two groups against each other. Equal skills, certainly an employer would be smart financially to take the employee who's subsidized. And that means the person who's doing without a form of government subsidy is put at a disadvantage to the person who has the government subsidy. And so maybe you could address, Mr. Kane, why you think that pitting these folks against each other is really good public policy here.
Representative Merkley, Chairman Lynn, with your permission, I'll defer the answer to that question to Mr. Courtney.
Well, no, I'd really like to get your understanding of this, since you testified before us before and you've spoken to us. I'd like to get your insight.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Great.
Representative Merkley, Chairman Lynn, we have strong beliefs, by the way, about the importance of work, and I testified extensively to that and other committees about the negative impact of being unemployed, positive impact of being employed. So the 8-week provision is very important to us for two reasons. One, we believe people are best placed at work, and that's where training best occurs. The other thing is that in order for this program to work successfully, early placement is necessary for there to be enough savings versus the utilization of a full range of benefits for 26 or 39 weeks in the program. And so the program, as you know, is funded by what would otherwise be benefits. And so that's why the program is tied to people who are eligible for benefits. The program also, by the way, I think I testified earlier, has such a positive impact on families that it potentially reduces the utilization of general fund dollars in other programs when families are healthier. But we're directly trying to avoid that by utilizing unemployment trust funds for services rather than general fund dollars, which, as you know, are extremely limited.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, but both people in this situation are unemployed and looking for work. And so to say this is healthier for one family, well, then the other family that doesn't get the job, it's a wash. So in this context of placing the new entry to the workforce against the first 8 weeks of unemployment, it's a wash between the impact on the two families.
Well, Representative Merkley, Chairman Lynn, I understand your concern here. We suggest that this should be a one tool in the many toolbox of the Employment Department. So this is not the only tool that is available to claimants or people that are not even on unemployment insurance benefits. It's simply one of many possible tools. And so, yes, it gives some an advantage, but there are other tools available to others.
One last question, Mr. Representative.
Senator. All right.
And then Representative Markley.
May I answer that?
Let me ask my last question. If there's time left and the chair permits, then I want to make sure I don't take up other folks.
It's the intention that since we don't have enough time to ask question and answer, I'm going to bring this back this Friday again. And after the floor session, we need to expect the long hours because that is the last time we are going to look at the House bills. So please bear that in mind. Thank you. Just go ahead.
The point was raised that on occasion this program is being used to fill temporary jobs. Mr. Kane, is that consistent with your understanding of the purpose of the program? Is it appropriate? Certainly we've had it clarified that it is permissible and legal, but is it appropriate?
Representative Merkley, Chairman Lynn, it's the intention of this program to fill newly created positions. If those positions turn out to be temporary, we still believe there's value in that experience, and it gives the person that's still a foot up to seek other work. So, but that's not where the emphasis of the program is designed to be. I know there was concerns expressed about our ability to audit this program and whether it's being abused in the way that you're potentially suggesting. And I can tell you that from talking to people in the field,
that those are not real concerns, and that we probably don't need a large and expensive auditing program, because the people that do the job development and the people that work in the work connection and the one-stop centers and so on generally have a good relationship with the employers in their area. They know when the abuse is happening. They have the discretionary power not to contract with people they know are abusing the program. So in talking with those people, I found that these are not real concerns at the field level. They believe they have a good relationship and can manage the program without an expensive audit.
No, it's not a real problem.
Okay.
Chairman, may I make one comment?
Just to wrap up your presentation.
Yes, thank you. There was one important question that was asked about the impact on taxes here that I think needs some major clarification. There was a suggestion that this program is taking $106 million out of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, and that's that. And therefore, taxes will rise. I can tell you from our studies, and I can give you a detailed spreadsheet on it, when it takes $106 million out to serve these are people who would be drawing $120 million otherwise. The net savings in the past two biennium has been $14 million to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. So I can simply just tell you this. Take the program away. You will raise taxes on employers. Those are the direct costs.
Yeah.
We know that there are $10 million in additional savings indirect. You will raise taxes on employers if you take
Can you away. Give us the documentation?
Yes, I can.
What you are claiming now. So please provide us so we can look at it before this Friday.
Chairman, I did not print out a copy of that today, but I will provide that to everyone on the committee.
Don't have it.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right. And since 11 o'clock, we need to go back to the floor. And with... I'd like to close public hearing and a work session on this the House Bill. What's that one? The 3307. There are Steve Lanning here that is going to testify, but if you indulge us, we will have your the testimony sometime this Friday. Is Steve here or is he gone? Yes. And thank you for your patience, and I deeply appreciate it that you are waiting so far and has to postpone until this Friday. If you could come, I will put you first. I do appreciate that. And then with that, I'd like to close up that work session on 3307, but make sure that I will bring this back on this Friday again. And before we adjourn, I'd like to have about 5-10 minutes with the bill, the 2174. I'd like to open work session 2174.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Oh, are we have testimony or did you want a motion?
Which one?
On 2174.
2174. Okay. I'd like to hear them first, since there is an extensive that amendment in it, and we need to go.
We're going to vote.
I don't think we have time to vote because there's an extensive amendment in it. We need to look at it, what's in it, and we need to move on.
Mr. Cool. Chairman, House Bill 2174, what you're looking at is the Dash 3 Amendment. You also have the Dash 1 Amendment previously. The Dash 3 Amendment replaces the measure and it restructures statutes authorizing and directing the use of the Special Works Fund. On the SMS, I described additional things that the amendment does, and in the interest of time, we won't go into that.
Okay, so Dash 2 Amendment, is that the inclusive all Dash 1 Amendment also?
It does not include the Dash 1. The Dash 1 is different.
Dash 1 is different, all right.
They would be, you could adopt both of them.
Okay.
But they're not included in it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, Gary Whitney?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Whitney. I'm the Infrastructure Policy and Program Coordinator for the Capital Projects Division of the Economic and Community Development Department. I've been asked to keep my comments to 10 minutes, so I have to throw out the other hour and 50 minutes of talk and try to condense it. The primary impact of House Bill 2174 is to streamline and simplify the Special Public Works Fund program. The statutory authorities are largely unchanged, and I'll get back to that in a second. To first give you a refresher on Special Public Works Fund, it's a revolving loan fund that's currently valued at about $145 million. It provides financing, primarily loans, some grant financing, to municipalities, which are cities, counties, ports, and service districts, for design, planning, and constructing municipally owned infrastructure. So municipally owned infrastructure in this context are the local road system, the municipal services, water, sewer, telecommunications, if there's a municipal energy utility, their facilities are eligible for financing as well. So that's what the program does. It's been in existence for, it'll be 20 years this July 1st. And as you can imagine, during that time, our economy and business climate has changed a lot. And the Special Public Works Fund program has undergone a lot of changes as well. As recently as 6 years ago, the legislature added a whole new project component, whereas the fund was originally focused strictly on infrastructure. It was broadened to include community facilities, which are buildings typically and other types of community-owned infrastructure. So we've added a whole project category, and then we originally excluded them from grants, and 2 years later we defined a special category of essential community facilities that could actually become eligible for grants under certain circumstances. And basically, the end result of all these changes is that we have a statute that is, we think, overly long and complex, and at times it's difficult to interpret. It's open to different interpretations, and that's probably the most troubling thing about it right now. So, as the department looked at our original House Bill 2174, we came to realize that it's really just another patch that we would be putting on top of the other patches that we already had there. And what we really needed to do was to bite the bullet and reorganize the statute. So we talked with our stakeholders, the ports representatives, the city representatives, the county representatives, and the special district representatives, and got them involved in work groups. And as soon as we had a working draft of the bill, we brought them in, got their comments, and kept them involved all along the way. And I think the bill is much stronger for it. Just to briefly give you the overview of what we've done, we've streamlined by combining the two eligible project construction types into one under one umbrella. It's now a development project that a municipality would pursue. We have currently two types of planning projects that a municipality could apply for, and we're saying, well, let's combine that under the clever title of a planning project so we don't have to do two of those. We're also proposing to remove some public hearing and notice requirements on municipalities before they adopt debt. We don't see any reason now to be adding additional things to municipalities' process. I mentioned that that the program's authorities are largely unchanged. We're proposing some small changes. One, we'd like to add airport districts to the list of eligible municipalities. There's only one airport district in the state right now, but we can see that as being an attractive mechanism for municipal airports in the near future, and we'd like them to be able to take advantage of the program. We're also suggesting that the program needs to clarify its ability to fund early-stage planning projects for municipalities when they want to do some planning for their economic and community development. But there's not a specific project yet identified, but we're talking about near-term planning for economic and community development. And we also think that municipalities should be able to come to the fund for purchasing land when the land parcel might be critical to their economic and community development plans. So those are the basic enhancements of the program. One of the things that the bill does is there's quite a few, actually 10 sections that are deleted, repealed, I guess is the correct term. And I'd like to briefly give you some details about that. 416 is a rather short statute. It's titled Allowable Project Costs, but it doesn't actually contain any language about allowable project costs. It just lists different types of activities. So we've taken and included those activities in the current bill, but we've created a new section that actually speaks to allowable and eligible project costs. 425 is related to community facility projects, and since we're doing away with that delineation, we don't need that reference anymore.
431, 434, and 438.
Tell me what you are talking about on this. You are talking from the
House Bill
2144, the amendment, right?
Yes.
What page is?
That's the last page.
Last page?
Yeah, there's a list of the sections that are repealed.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe I distributed copies of those statutes to the members.
Yes, you did.
I'm not finding mine.
Yes. It is very difficult to just go in. But and if possible, I'd like to have a meeting with you or Mark Sessler in my office before Friday. I'd like to go with you section by section.
Okay.
What we are changing, and in this the 11th hour, trying to explain that what it is. It is very difficult. We are not focused well since we are going back to session pretty soon. So if you could do that, I'd appreciate. Please call my office and make arrangement because I asked it for this meeting. Okay.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Yeah. So if any members of this committee wants to have a meeting with them to explain, and that also be advisable. Yes, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, can I please ask Mr. Whitney why we have specific references to certain cities? I mean, it seems strange to me we'd have a bill like this, and then we're talking about what we're going to do for Medford and all of those locations. That seems strange to me.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
Where is Medford mentioned?
Well, I can bring it up to you if you like, so not to take your time.
Okay, so why don't you get together with Representative Nelson,
right,
and explore further on this matter. All right, and then
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there is reference to any particular municipality in the statute. There is reference to municipalities, which were defined as including cities and counties, the Port of Portland, and a few other public entities such as that. And then there are lots of examples.
In page 3 of the bill, beginning with line 7.
It's, Chair. Lynn, Representative Nelson, I think this is in relation to what used to be referred to as entitlement areas, and so we were calling them urban infrastructure projects if they were located within the boundaries of these municipalities, and we're keeping this general intent, but instead we're referring to them as rural projects or non-rural projects. So projects that were taking place, we're taking out the specific references to these municipalities and just referring to these as urban areas, and projects that are taking place in these areas are urban areas projects. And there's some other statutory language that says the program benefits have to be split, I think 60-40, to rural versus urban.
Okay, because that could be huge. And
We're keeping the intent
and
here.
Okay, and
excuse me,
that really
Chairman.
Concerned me once again. You know.
Okay, so please get together with Ms. Nelson also. Just ask any questions she might have. With that, Ken, I'm sorry I couldn't put you on today, but certainly we will have a chance to talk this coming Friday. Appreciate it. And with that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2174. With that, since there's no... Ms. Chin.
Yeah, you want to carry it over to Friday. Make sure
it's... Yes. We will carry over to Friday.
We'll carry this over to
Friday.
Yes.
Okay. With that, since there's no other business before us, meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.